You've been listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 1, powered by Rust-Oleum, home of trusted quality and powerful solutions since 1921. If you've got a surface to protect or a look you want to transform, home or industry, Rust-Oleum has a solution for every challenge.
TSN 1050 online, tsn1050.ca, your home smart speaker and up on TSN 4. Brian Hayes, Doug, Jeff O'Neill, Jamie Noodles McLennan. Day one of the Euros, and Italy takes the first game of the tournament, 3-0 over Turkey. So shout out to Italy.
Forza.
And yeah, Forza. And Turkey will have to get up off the mat. We'll see what happens. But all these games will be heard on TSN Radio, seen on TSN. The French Open, they got a semifinal cooking right now that is world class. It's Nadal versus Djokovic. Djokovic is up 2-1. But I think the significance of the whole match, outside of the fact that these are two studs and it looks
Dude,
like it's going to be...
People are saying it's the greatest match of all time.
Yeah, like Nadal just broke him early into the fourth set. So if he can win that set, we're going to a fifth set tiebreak here. But they have allowed 5,000 people in the stadium, right? A 5,000-person capacity. And I guess in Paris, maybe throughout the country, I don't know, there's a curfew still. There's a COVID curfew, I believe.
Not now.
And did you see the video of the guy who got on the mic and he's reading it off his phone?
Yeah.
And it sounds as if it was right from like a government official. And they announced it to the crowd, the 5,000 people in the stadium, they didn't have to go home for the curfew. The curfew
Dude,
did not apply
the bar
to
bar play on that guy tonight.
Oh, and the pop. It sounded like a WWE pop when like Stone Cold shows up out of nowhere. People were going crazy.
Yeah,
because of the significance of the match and the fact that you don't have to leave, how
okay,
cool would
Hayes,
that be?
What I don't understand, like, I'm just street smart, right? But why would they even time this match at a time that would even come close to interfering with the curfew? Like, are you for real? Are you for real? If there's a curfew, why is it scheduled when it could possibly run into the curfew?
I don't have the answer for you.
Exactly. Right. How dumb can people be?
Following that closely, so I don't know what has been happening throughout the tournament.
You know what the PGA Tour does on Sundays? If there's rain coming late in the afternoon, they tee off early. Early. So they don't run into the rain.
Listen, this is a better story. Who cares about the reasoning behind it? The fact is some guy got on the mic. And I don't know if they reached out to Macron, who's not getting slapped today. He's at the G7. You see him get slapped a couple of days ago in southern France? Yeah, the president of France was doing like walking around and some woman slapped him. And it was really a pretty wild scene because the security got in there and was like, get him out of here.
That's a threat. Like they could have used like serious force to injure that lady, take her down, like anybody goes near, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was doing the shaking the hands, kissing babies, hey, how's everyone doing? So I guess he put himself in a position where he would be with the crowd. It's not like she ran on stage and slapped him, but she did. She gave him a pretty good whack, too. And
I know the world is sometimes crazy. You think back. It wasn't that long ago. Wasn't it George Bush that was somewhere overseas and the guy threw a shoe at him twice?
That's right. Yeah. And I guess it was a cultural thing where if you have a real significant issue with someone, you throw a shoe at them.
Twice the guy threw it.
And had heat, dude. This thing was like like Chapman-esque.
He was dodging it.
Yeah.
Like,
and it was like one of Carlo's square-toed Italian shoes, too.
It was a serious loafer. But, like, could you imagine if that happened in today's world? Like, you know, how long ago was that? 20 years ago?
No, not even 20. Maybe. But he got into office in 2000 or 2001. So he was in there for eight years. I mean, I don't remember the date, but it may have been 15 years ago, 20 years ago, give or take.
Yeah, but it just...
But that could still happen now. I mean, with COVID and everything, just people haven't been in the same room. But at some point, I assume we'll get back to that. Like, we'll get in. I mean, speaking of being in the room and dealing with a podium, the Nathan MacKinnon, Adrian Dater thing last night.
I've known Adrian.
Is that Dater that
years.
Asked that question?
Yeah. I've known him for 100 years, but that is completely offside, completely
Dude,
ridiculous.
He sounded drunk asking that question. I'm sorry. That wasn't a normal question for somebody that knew what they were talking about.
Well, he's been a lot. Like, I played in Denver the year before they won the NHL team went there. I played in a minor league team there, the Denver Grizzlies. We won the cup. the IHL Turner Cup. Like, Denver is a brilliant city. I love it so much. But Dater was around back then. Like, he's a lifer there.
Yeah, he's a long-time hockey guy, Denver guy, but that, I don't know.
I hated the question.
He sounded like he was half in the bag. And well, I know he's had issues with that in the past, I believe, and he had to leave Twitter or whatever, but you can't – what are you doing,
well,
man?
Well, he's had some stuff, but, like, I don't know where sometimes fandom – and the reporting stop sometimes. And it's not just reserved for Adrian. There's lots of scribes in lots of different cities that get so worked up because they're mad at the team. Like, that sounded like Adrian was so disappointed that he thought that the Avalanche was going to go all the way.
I think it. Like, should we play it? I mean, we're referencing it here.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, it's viral. It's a public.
It is.
On live. It's Nathan MacKinnon who's at the podium. We have it sent, so why don't we play it? And you're right. Dater's been doing it forever. He did jump on Twitter to explain it. He said, it got away from me. He said, that's why I'm a newspaper guy. I'm not a broadcaster. And he was trying to find a question that I don't know what he was trying to achieve.
Long enough, Hayes, where that's just amateur hour.
It was a really weird way of phrasing it. Let's just play it, and then we'll come back and react to it.
Nate, you know, I know you're a gamer and all this, and, you know, I'm just thinking maybe out loud as far as in your shoes right now. It's like, all right, we've done all the thinking we can do. We've done all the game planning we can do. Maybe, you know, just f*** it. We'll just go in next year and just not think anymore and just win this thing when we don't think so much. Is that, am I on the right path at all with this? Like, maybe you just guys think a little too much? No.
Last one here for Nathan.
No.
Dude, yeah. I can tell by somebody's voice that he's not in a good state there, the question asker. Sorry.
Well, let's not get – who knows what's going on there. We're not going to play that game and react. Yeah. Who cares? Like, that's for him to figure out. But, listen, MacKinnon handled it kind of how you would expect to. The question basically was, even though it was a jumbled mess, do you plan too much? Do you overthink?
Yeah, like I understood what he – I almost felt like I knew what he was trying to say.
But even that feels like a cop-out to me. Like, what, Colorado cares more than Vegas? Vegas was just winging it. They were out the night before, and that's why they won.
How about
like,
Vegas
it still played
doesn't
great. Make any sense. Exactly. Vegas was just better. And that's why Vegas is through, why Colorado's at home now.
And they couldn't – and honestly, Colorado couldn't get a say. I thought Grubauer was terrible last night.
That first goal, I don't think I've ever seen something like that. It was like he was looking in behind the net, and the puck was at the point.
I know. I mean, he'd lost track of the puck. But, like, you're in the first minute of the game, and you're up 1-0. You've got to find that puck. Like, there's so many I thought Fleury outplayed him the last couple games, and that's the difference. Because Colorado, for me, in Game 5, deserved that game, but they didn't deserve Game 2. Grubauer was brilliant. But the last two games for me in net, I didn't like Grubauer's games. I really didn't. I thought Fleury was the better goaltender. He came up with the bigger saves at the bigger time. And you know what? Vegas deserves every ounce of credit here. And Colorado, they didn't capitalize on their chances. They didn't bury him when they needed to. And unfortunately, they're going home.
Yeah, they're going home. And it's interesting because Lou Lamoriello, I guess, was speaking this afternoon. And you know how Lou is. And you know how Lou runs his operation. And Lamoriello said earlier today, quote, I've always said this, individual players can help you win games, but if you want to win a championship, it has to be one complete team, end quote. So, you know, he says that with the understanding that he won three cups in Jersey with one of the greatest goaltenders of all time, two of the greatest defensemen of all time. So he's also had exceptional players, right?
Sure.
And some great forwards. But the Islanders are not a team loaded with superstars. And you look who's been nominated for the Hart. McDavid didn't win a game. Matthews, we know what
didn't
happened there.
Round.
And MacKinnon won one round and then faded. Like, he was kind of a non-factor, really, against Vegas for the most part. He didn't dominate by any stretch. So those are your Hart nominees. All of them had spectacular seasons. All of them had teams where you thought they got a real shot if those guys do what they're supposed to do.
Get going, yeah.
But clearly it wasn't enough. You know, clearly you need help top to bottom where you can't rely on one guy to drag you somewhere.
Well,
it just isn't going to happen.
And you saw right away our buddy Kadri trending like, could he have helped? You know what I mean? Like, even if it's.
He could have.
He would have helped, but not to the point where it goes over the top. I think Vegas was just better.
You're right, but maybe he gets a different matchup. Maybe he helps out, chips in a goal here or there. Like, I'm not going to lay it all at his feet, but to win in the playoffs, you have to have everything firing on all cylinders. You need goaltending. You need special teams. You need four lines that are rolling. You need guys that are committed to blocking shots and doing everything. That was Vegas. That's Mark Stone. I loved the comments coming out of Vegas today saying, there's a lot of great teams that are sitting at home right now. Our guys, it was leadership. It was character. Like, it wasn't like, hey, we were systematically strong in the neutral zone. It was like these guys dug in at the right time. And there's one common theme with a lot of these teams that are sitting at home, and that's Toronto too, is – the rest of the group, including the top guys, didn't dig in when the chips were down. And
well, look at the teams that are left now. Now, Tampa's the outlier because Tampa plays shinny at times. They'll win 5-4, 6-5. They can do it both ways. You look at the way they closed the series. They went 2-0, and they just kind of said, we're gonna end this here tonight. We'll check you into the ground, and Vasilevsky will be there for us. Yeah. But they're happy to play it both ways, and they have Globetrotters on that team. Yeah. But Vegas, Montreal, the Islanders, who is the flashiest forward on those three teams?
It's not worth mentioning.
It's not. Like,
well,
Mark
Barzal,
Stone isn't, but he's not flashy, though. Stone is not flashy. He's almost further down the list because he's the furthest thing from flashy.
Yeah, he's chipping and chasing.
Pacioretty, I don't know. Suzuki maybe has a little bit of flash, but not really.
Maybe
like,
Caulfield.
It might be Caulfield. It could be Caulfield.
Barzal has some flash, but I think they've got a blanket on him a little bit. Like
you're right.
He's got flash, but what he does is he kind of he plays within the system, so it kind of takes away from him.
Yeah, he doesn't go searching for it. If it's there, he'll take advantage of it, but he's not going to fall out of the comfort zone that Trotz demands. So that's what's left. Outside of Tampa, there's a lot of teams that are just kind of top to bottom, grind it out, check it out. Solid team. So the Habs are going to play Vegas. That'll start on Monday night. And Tampa's got the Islanders. That'll start on Sunday afternoon. So we'll get to that. Ray will join us. Ray Ferraro in about an hour. Ray's coming up at 6:05. Gregor Chisholm later in the hour. The Jays are at Fenway for four starting tonight. They dropped 2 of 3 in Chicago. They're a couple games over 500, 60 games into the season. So we'll get to that a little bit later on. But Pascal Siakam, this effectively came out of nowhere. And I don't know if this is COVID-related, Zoom call-related, off-season-related. But all of a sudden, Siakam has surgery to repair a torn labrum. He's out for 5 months.
I got questions for Josh.
Okay, let's bring in our Raptors reporter, Josh Lewenberg. Correct me if I'm wrong, Josh. I don't remember hearing anything about this at the end of the season. Was this always a possibility? Where do we stand on this in terms of where this came from, Siakam all of a sudden having to have surgery the way that he did?
Well, Brian, what's fascinating now, especially in hindsight, is we knew about the shoulder injury to a degree, right? I stress the word knew because we knew that Pascal Siakam was out for something. I mean, what they listed him as was a shoulder injury. He left the game against Memphis on May 8th. He missed the final four games. But I think what most of us assumed is that he, like a lot of the other guys, were sitting out as a extreme precaution or for tanking purposes because the Raptors were looking to, at the time, lose games or just play out the rest of the season. Obviously it was far more serious than that. And you're right. This is sort of out of the blue in terms of the surgery. We didn't know that this was something that was planned. And speaking to a source close to Pascal Siakam today, it wasn't even in the initial plan. I mean, the Raptors sat down with Siakam after the season did come to an end, and the plan, or at least the hope at that point, was to take the rest and rehab approach to avoid surgery and just hope that with time this thing sort of heals on its own. But ultimately, the risk of re-injury, and I think also the severity of an injury, if there were to be a second subsequent injury, was deemed to be too high. So they opt for surgery now, which I think in the long term, from what it sounds like, is the best course of action. It's going to ensure that the shoulder heals properly and strengthens and all of that. But obviously, the short-term implication it's a tough blow for him and for the Raptors, another obstacle that he has to deal with, another setback that he has to deal with, because not only, if you look at the timetable here, expected to be 5 months, not only does that mean that he gets back sometime in the early to mid-November period, which would mean he misses the first few weeks of the season, but obviously it also means that this offseason is not going to go according to plan here. After a disappointing year, he was hoping to really use this lengthy offseason to get back in the gym and work on his game and growth and development and all that. Now the plan changes to rehab and recovery. So I think this is a huge blow for a player that was going into a really important offseason.
Josh, what I don't get about it is I've had three labrum surgeries done. Rest and relaxation does not heal it, period, flat out period. So once this was diagnosed, why was there an extra month wasted? It's part of the reason why I can't stand Fergie, is because he made me play useless games with a torn labrum, and I should have had surgery. As soon as this is diagnosed and he has surgery right away, maybe he's on track and time to be back next season. Instead, he's not going to be ready for the season next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, and the difference in the grand scheme of things is 2 weeks, which isn't huge, but at the same time, like, let's say he returns a couple weeks into the season now, which is sort of what it looks like. The timetable, like I said, places him in early November. Season's supposed to start now. We got word yesterday that the season is back on track to be in its regular time frame, about an October 19th start to the year. So yeah, it could be 2-3 weeks into the season that he's able to come back. If he had gotten the surgery right after the season ended, then maybe he's ready to go on opening night. Yeah, I like I said, that's what I was told, that the hope was that maybe they take the other approach, avoid surgery. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of tough to come to terms with that now, considering how obvious the surgery route seems in hindsight.
With Josh Lewenberger, TSN Raptors reporter. Again, news today, Pascal Siakam surgery on his torn labrum. That will keep him out upwards of 5 months, which should lean into early to mid-November, which will be well into the season at that point. And as you've noted many times today, Josh, it knocks him out in terms of full rehab, in terms of a full offseason, in terms of preparing and trying to grow his game, which is clear it has to happen, which really isn't a good sign considering his contractual situation, right? He's a max player. This year was year one of a max deal, and it didn't go very well. The fact that he still has to continue to find different elements of his game might suggest he is who he is. And quite frankly, when I think of who Siakam, what he needs to improve on, it's confidence and it's a clutch gene. You can't find that in the gym in July. Like, bulk up a little bit, sure, but what is he really planning on working on this offseason that was going to drastically change his game next year?
Well, Brian, a couple things stand out. I think, first of all, lost in all of the inconsistency and disappointment with the late game shots and all of that, this year was that Siakam was actually playing pretty well to close the year. If you look at his numbers over the last 22, 23 games that he played, I know they're just numbers, and obviously the eye test showed that he was still not that player that he needs to be late in the game, but the numbers were right on par with what he was doing the year before when he was an all-star, all-NBA. Like, we're talking 24 points a game, 8 rebounds, 45, 46, 47% shooting somewhere in there. He was playing some of the best basketball of his career late in the season, in between the health and safety protocols and then the shoulder injury at the end of the year. So I do think that there would have been value, obviously, and I said this at the time, of closing the season strong with some confidence going into this really important offseason, and then working on his game. And that's the other thing, is one of the biggest strengths of Pascal Siakam, going back to when he was a young player and far from the player that he's turned into today, is that he's always been able to use the summer to address the weaknesses in his game, to identify them and turn them into strengths. Like DeMar DeRozan before him, he has really improved during a lot of these off seasons, and in large part because of the exhaustive off-season training and development program that he goes through every year in LA. And the off season, to be clear, it's not completely lost. Like, nothing's stopping him now from going and watching film. He can do that all day, every day, and analyze what went wrong. And I do think there's some value in that, obviously, in the self-awareness of, okay, what went wrong in this game? How come I didn't close this game well and all of that? But you're right. You can only get so much from that. He can still work on certain aspects of his game, albeit in a limited capacity. He's supposed to be able to get back on the court and do some limited individual work next month. But in terms of participating in those star-studded UCLA runs that he's always in every summer, with Rico Hines and all of that, I think those things have really helped him grow as a player, being able to play against Kevin Durant. I think those things help elevate your game, especially your role as the lead guy. He's not going to be able to do any of that this summer, and I think that's what really hurts.
With Josh Lewenberger, a TSN Raptors reporter. Go ahead, Noodles.
Josh, I wanted to see if you had an update on Masai. I mean, it's just, we've been talking about it for weeks on the show. It's you know, quiet and, you know, is there anything, or do you get an inkling like that he's going to stay or he's going to go? Like, you know, what's your gut feeling on it? Because maybe it's a cone of silence out of there.
Yeah, Noodles, it's eerily quiet right now. I mean, Masai, I know, has been in Africa for a while. And even when we spoke to him, whatever that was, 2 or 3 weeks ago after the season, I asked him if there was any timeline for sitting down and figuring out what the future holds for him and getting a deal done or not getting a deal done. And I sensed zero urgency from him. I mean, he just sort of said, we'll get to it when we get to it, which is funny because I imagine it's got to be the opposite approach right now for MLSC, who obviously want to get this thing done for a bunch of reasons. But if for nothing else, having some certainty going into, as we talked about, a really important offseason for the Raptors, going into this draft lottery on June 22nd, going into the draft on July 29th, and then especially going into free agency, you need to know what that front office looks like. I mean, Kyle Lowry said it himself. What Masai does is going to play a part ultimately in what Kyle decides to do. So it is bizarre that Masai doesn't really seem to have that sense of urgency. I mean, maybe it's a leverage thing, a negotiation thing. As I said, after we spoke to him a few weeks ago, I do think that there's reason for encouragement if Masai, as he said to us then, if it comes down to ownership's commitment to winning and competing for championships, I highly doubt that there's anything that he could ask for that MLSC would say, well, no, actually, we're not going to give you that. So that's what it comes down to. Masai will be back, but I also think, I mean, listen, this is a smart man, and that could have also been a tactical move, because all this time we've been saying the ball is in Masai's court. Whatever Masai wants to do, that's what's going to happen. I still think that's the case. But at least optically speaking, he has now put the ball in MLSC's court, right? That's the perception now, is that whether or not they give him what he's looking for, whether or not they're committed to winning, is going to determine whether he comes back. So if he doesn't, who is that going to look bad on now? I don't think people are going to be critical of Masai. I think people are going to look at MLSC and say, well, what happened here?
Well, hopefully we get some sort of an answer one way or the other, and hopefully it's a positive one. For Raptors fans, and we know where Maple Leafs sports and entertainment ultimately stand on this, but Masai is going to have to, I guess, hop to it here, and, yeah, and we'll see where it goes. Thank you, Josh. As always, appreciate it.
All right, guys. Take care.
Josh Lewenberger, TSN Raptors reporter. Yeah, there's a lot hanging over the Raps. I mean, the draft lottery is still to come, so we'll see if they get lucky on draft night or draft lottery night. And then the draft itself, they're going to pick likely in the top 10 for the first time in a long time. Lowry's out there, Masai's out there. They got to make some big decisions. And now Siakam, who knows what he's going to look like when he returns. I think big picture, it's not going to derail his career or anything along those lines. But I don't know if you can embrace a big step forward, and I'm not sure that was going to be there anyway, surgery or otherwise. I mean, Siakam's a big boy. He's been in the league for a while now. You know, he's not 18, 19 coming out of high school. He's pretty established. So they need him, though. They need him at 100%. They need him to be better, more consistent than he was this year. The Jays are at Fenway for 4 starting tonight. Ryu will not pitch in any of them. He got blown up in the first inning and then settled right in like he always does last night. And the bats couldn't come alive. Like, if Simeon isn't rolling, if Vladdy's not rolling, it wasn't there. But Biggio is back. Kevin Biggio is back. He'll be playing third tonight. Espinal has been optioned. So Biggio's back, and we'll get you an update on the lineup, what to expect out of the Jays at Fenway, and Ray Ferraro coming up just after 6 o'clock. I believe Al's brother's kicking around the studio. Maybe nice. Ask him about the Euros and what he thinks about our draft picks.
He'll have insight. Did our pool.
I think he'll have some insight on that. So we'll kick up into high gear with Al's brother and his Euro 2020 analysis. We love it. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on TSN 4. Chicken strips on the mound. Your boy, Ross Stripling. So
he'll
that's
be
always
in.
Positive. Yeah, he should be at Fenway. Yeah, for sure. It's a chicken strip type of park. And listen, Friday night, Fenway, I'm pretty sure that's packed house. You see Wrigley today. They played an afternoon game. Full capacity, and I'm pretty sure every seat was filled.
It's over.
Rizzo hit a bomb in the sixth inning, and the place went absolutely bananas, and he was going crazy too. Like, the players are feeding off the energy. Vegas last night, the players were going nuts.
Yeah.
And it's just
that building
because you have
was...
such an appreciation for it, because every athlete over the last year has played in front of multiple empty stadiums.
Yeah.
And you knew it, you felt it, and then I think everyone just has such an appreciation for what the fans bring and just the atmosphere in a building.
Lee Westwood, the golfer, tweeted last night, he's like, first ever hockey game. I'm like, this dude is walking in to an absolute zoo. Vegas clinches. It's like, what a first hockey game for a pro golfer to go to.
Not bad.
And you know, I talked to a buddy who was staying at Encore this morning. He FaceTimed me, and he was like, the city was rocking. That's
the locals make it work that way, right? Like, the locals love the Golden Knights.
Yeah.
So, and if you're visiting, you're like, all right, if we're all doing this tonight, you know, like, let's do it.
I saw a bunch of tweets, Hayes, saying the NBA, like, they're stupid not to look into this. Like,
they're going to Vegas. They're going to Vegas. It's all what you needed was one league to do it first.
I didn't think it would be the NHL, I'll tell you that.
I didn't either, based on their nature, based on their history, the sport itself. But they got there first, and I'm sure they're ecstatic that they did. They should be, because they've established roots in the city, and obviously it's a big deal there. Now the football team's there. The NBA will be there in the next decade, I'll bet. It's either a team will move there or they'll expand. Yeah, I fully expect that, because Vegas has proven that they can do it. That they have enough local support, and you get enough people that show up into town and are looking for things to do and tickets and all that kind of stuff. And
well, it's such an entertainment city. That's why I had maintained, you know, going into it. You and I had disagreed on it because I was like, Vegas, they know how to entertain. Now, you may think it's cheesy. You may think it's corny, but they've got the whole pregame buildup and circus and the act and all of that, and the owner's in a helicopter, and it's just like people eat it up because it's like, hey, we're going to go to a hockey game, then we're going to go for dinner at 10 o'clock, and then we're going to the club at midnight. And that's how Vegas is going to roll. Like, and they'll make it an entertainment situation. So I had no doubt. And there will be times, maybe sooner than you think, when the Golden Knights are junk, because they're going to, the cap thing's going to catch up. Their players are going to look older on long-term deals, but we'll still go, you know, the Leafs are in town. They'll still sell out.
Yeah. They'll still get people flying in. I do. It's going to feel very different. The locals will not have the same vibe. I think the NBA has a better chance of selling their product if the local team is bad, because the superstars are so prevalent in the NBA,
right?
LeBron's in town or KD's in town, like, got to go see him. You can sell that. I'm not sure the NHL has the same ability to sell to everyone in Vegas and throughout the state. You know, McDavid's here or Sid's here. It just doesn't ring out the same way.
Right.
But the NBA is going to Vegas. They're going to get there for sure. And what a clash we're going to see here. We'll get into it in about a half an hour with Ray, where arguably the oldest, most storied franchise in the National Hockey League in Montreal is going up against a team that has gold jerseys and came on the scene
too.
3 years ago.
Exactly.
You know, Vegas and Montreal could not be any different in terms of their hockey history. And it's go time. So we'll get to that in about a half an hour. Here is Gregor Chisholm of the Toronto Star. The Jays are at Fenway for four starting tonight. What's happening, Gregor?
Not much. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. Biggio is back, and I think this was to be expected. So Cavan will play third tonight, which has not gone over so well. Like, before he got injured, they were shifting him around a lot because I'm not sure how comfortable they were with him playing at third. I think it's the right move to bring him back and try to reestablish that. How do you feel about that decision?
Yeah, no, I think they need to keep him at third base for now. I mean, this isn't going to be a long-term thing, and a couple years down the road, he's not going to be the third baseman for this team. But you look at what the Jays have right now, and really he's the only option unless you really want to get creative by moving Semien around. And, I mean, he's looked so good at second base, and he's done so much with the bat, you don't really want to mess with anything that's going on there. And so if you're not going to put him back at second base, then Biggio pretty much has to be your third baseman. And he can do an okay job, but he is the kind of guy who the more he plays there, the more warts you do kind of see. And the arm is certainly questionable over there. It's going to get erratic at times, and he's going to have some issues. But for the most part, he's going to be he should be able to play a relatively solid third base. And it gives the Jays enough for right now until they kind of retool again in the offseason. And then you obviously have guys like Austin Martin and Jordan Groshans in the system who are probably going to take up one of those infield spots in the coming years as well. So I think it's doable for right now. What he really needs to do is just get over his slow start. I mean, he got off to a terrible start in April. I mean, he's still giving you good at-bats in terms of, like, working deep counts and getting walks, but the rest of the production just hasn't been there. So from a Jays perspective, they have to hope that this injury is almost good news in a way, and that it affords him an opportunity for a bit of a fresh start after a bit of a breather.
You just mentioned retooling in the offseason. Is that where you think this is trending right now, the direction is the offseason and it being a massive one for the Jays, and then they kind of put their stamp on this and say, okay, fellas, it's go time? Or do you see anything happening before that? Because they're kind of doing the same thing they did last year. They're hovering around the 500 mark, and then they'll maybe make a push. Maybe they'll fall off, and it's kind of a coin flip right now. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think you're going to see a trade deadline like 2015. It's not really in this front office, I don't think, to go and trade away a bunch of the assets that they've been building up in the minor leagues. It seems like there's something that they're hesitant to do, at least in terms of the top guys. I think what you're going to probably see is more of an approach like it was last year, where they got Robbie Ray and they got Taijuan Walker, and they kind of added those pieces on the periphery a little bit. Like, I'd be stunned if this team ends up making a big run at Max Scherzer or something around July 31st if he ends up becoming available. I think they'd be in on it, but I'd be surprised if when push came to shove that, you know, this front office parts with the assets that it would take to make that kind of move. So, you know, I think you're looking at another offseason like the one that the Jays just had, where they're going to try and spend their money a little bit and buy some from free agency. But, I mean, in terms of this specific season, they still need to make some moves. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they obviously need to address the issues with the rotation. They're going to have to do something with the bullpen that's running on fumes and is running out of men down there. There are some internal options, like in the minor leagues, they could transition some of their starters to the bullpen. They've got some flexibility in the second half to do some of those type of things, but they can't do that if they don't get the starting depth in the first place. And so they're going to need to add at least kind of one big piece to that rotation, if not two, and then deal with the bullpen after that in terms of, you know, how they're going to solve that. Because right now, I mean, the bullpen is by far the biggest weakness. And if this team goes into a slide, that's probably going to be the reason why. I mean, we've seen so many winnable games slip away from the Jays earlier this year. It really was probably more on the offense, but that hasn't been the case since April. I mean, the offense has obviously held up at the end of the bargain recently, and, you know, the Jays are finding themselves in the middle of a tough schedule against some really good teams, and they've let too many games slip away. I mean, there's just not too many guys down there right now that Charlie Montoyo can trust. I mean, really, you've got Jordan Romano, maybe Rafael Dolis, if you're willing to put up with a heart attack on his way to actually getting the job done. And outside of that, I mean, you really don't have anything, especially since Tyler Chatwood really kind of fell apart there a couple weeks ago.
With Gregor Chisholm, and then you look at the catching position, which I don't believe is solidified either, yet they've got a lot of options. Like, Riley Adams came up this weekend. He played in all three games. You know, he came in the second game as a pinch hitter, then a defensive replacement. But he's a big boy. He's not young. He's 24 years old, but he's still relatively young. So is Jansen. So is Kirk. So is McGuire. I don't see any of them, though, being a guy you believe you can just plug and play for the next 5, 7, 10 years. So how do you see the carousel at the catching position playing out?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I still think Moreno, Gabriel Moreno, in the minor leagues in Double A is going to be the more long-term guy. To me, he's been the one for the last couple of years who the hype has really kind of been building on, and is probably more the long-term piece. But overall, it's not really a position that I'm particularly worried about with the Jays. I mean, I think they've got so many guys, they've got so many bodies there that you kind of expect at least one of them is going to pan out. I mean, so many times when we talk about Jays prospects, you know, the big guys, they have to pan out. Otherwise, it's going to mean really bad things for the organization. Behind the plate, because of the number of bodies that they have, they do have some flexibility there. So, I mean, obviously, Danny Jansen hasn't started his career the way he wanted it to. And, I mean, the bat that was in the minor leagues just still hasn't translated 4 years into the majors. And he's going to give you some good defense, but you're not getting any offensive production really there at all. And Reese McGuire, to me, is just a backup and not much more. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, like, when Kirk eventually comes back. I mean, the bat, there's a lot to like there. Defensively, there's still a lot of question marks as to whether or not he can become a long-term piece. And Riley Adams is someone I've always viewed as more of a depth type guy. I viewed him more as kind of in the Reese McGuire mold, but he's gotten off to a good start. And so, I mean, it's possible that he will, you know, increase his value and show something. But to me, if the Jays are going to make some moves, I mean, that's the position you need to leverage. I mean, when you've got five guys on your 40-man roster, you're not going to get anything from McGuire, but some of the other guys, you can potentially look to make a move there. And whether that's at the deadline or this offseason, to package, you know, one of those guys into another deal that's a bit bigger to get something in return.
Noticed you on Twitter, you're not necessarily, you know, itching for more George Springer injury updates. I think I'm probably addressing that appropriately. It sounds like you've kind of had enough of Charlie Montoyo trying to convince the world that this guy's a day away from, you know, going on a Cal Ripken streak of, you know, day in, day out play, because it is the same thing every day. He's really close. He's running the bases, and then there's no real update, and he doesn't do anything here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's the daily update of him running the bases and doing some sprints in the outfield, and it seems like it's been going on for about a month. You know, some of this is how the Jays relay a lot of this information. Like, I know the organization is very hesitant to put timelines on guys because they don't like the disappointment or the pressure that comes with trying to get those players back. If they say someone's going to be out for 3 to 4 weeks and it ends up being 5 to 6, they think it looks bad on them. I have a different opinion on it. I think the daily updates that don't say much, you know, kind of leave a bit of stain on the organization anyways. I mean, people have been kind of mocking this George Springer situation for the last couple of weeks because you're right. I mean, it just hasn't changed. But originally when he went down, I mean, I was expecting him to be out about a month. It's been about 5 weeks, so he's a little bit behind schedule, what I originally thought, but he's not that far behind. And it does look as cliche as it sounds over the last updates from the last 2 weeks where it's always close. I mean, it really does sound like he actually is close now. Probably should get out on a rehab assignment within a couple of days and then, you know, probably looking at sometime next week potentially to make his debut. But I mean, I certainly could have gone with it the last 2-3 weeks. Of, oh, yeah, he's getting close. He's getting close. He's running the bases. He's doing all that. I mean, it's the same thing.
Running the bases.
I love running the bases. The pom-poms are up for the base run. It's awesome to see.
Ridiculous.
So the Jays are at Fenway for four starting tonight. They're 5.5 back of the Sox, 6.5 back of Tampa. Of those two teams, which one do you think has to be pursued the hardest? In other words, which one do you think has the best chance of actually winning the AL East, or would you include the Yankees in that as well? Who are the Jays chasing atop the American League East in a month, 2 months, 3 months from now?
I mean, I'm surprised at my own answer to this, but I think it's the Rays. And the Rays were the team. You know, last year I was pretty high in the Rays. I picked them to go all the way to the World Series before the year. I'm typically someone who likes what the Rays organization does across the board in terms of their development. But this year, after losing a couple of starting pitchers, Charlie Morton and Blake Snell, you know, I really actually did think that this was going to be a year where they take a step back, and you just look at the assets that organization has and the way they've been able to play so far this year, and they've done a great job. They've defied the odds again. And another reason why I like them, I mean, similar situation to the Blue Jays, they've had one of the tougher schedules in Major League Baseball so far, and they're going to be in a position in the second half where they can go on a bit of a run when they take advantage of some of the, you know, the lesser opponents. I mean, the Jays as well, they haven't played the Orioles once this year. They're going to hit the soft spot of their schedule here in about another week. And so there's a potential there to go on a bit of a run. But, yeah, I just like everything about what the Rays are doing right now. And, I mean, the Yankees were my original pick. And I've hung on to that until probably about a couple weeks ago. And I don't think they're going to completely go away. But that organization has more issues than I would have thought going into the year. And they've got to figure out some things on the mound. And they've got some aging veterans in the everyday lineup that, similar to the Jays, have gotten hurt and the production just hasn't been there.
Can I ask you about a play last night? And it just, I don't know why it irritated me. I think one of the biggest elements to being a professional athlete, and Jamie knows this more than anybody because he was a goalie, but just being ready. Like Gurriel Jr., it was the first inning. I believe it was the first inning. And he just turned the wrong way. Like, is he just young and learning? Is he bad at fielding? Because it was just a play that had to be made, and it ultimately cost him. It was a major factor in the game, and he just didn't get it done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, this is now like what, his third year in the outfield. I know he came up as an infielder, but you know, he's not that young anymore. He's not that inexperienced anymore. He somehow was nominated for a Gold Glove last year. I have no idea how that actually happened. That's kind of what they're dealing with in left field right now. I mean, he's got the arm, so I think that's why he got the Gold Glove nomination. But we've seen terrible roots from him time and time again. And so 2 years ago when we saw that, you kind of understand a little bit. The transition's still going on, and you see the room for growth. And now when you look at it, it's a little bit more, okay, this is a bit more of a permanent problem. I mean, we saw Teoscar Hernandez a couple of years ago experience kind of similar issues in left field, and I don't think anyone's expecting him to turn into a Gold Glover. Lourdes Gurriel is in a similar boat. And I think you're right. I think he got caught guessing a little bit last night. He thought it was going to go to the line. He got twisted around. And, I mean, that's been his big issue out there. I mean, he gets terrible reads off the bat, and sometimes he can make up for his speed. But a lot of times he can't, and it continues to be an issue for the Jays, and is only going to become a bigger one the more competitive games that they play in, and especially in tight ball games. You just can't really have some of those mistakes. I mean, I know the White Sox just came off a very sloppy series too. It's not like good teams can't make some of these miscues, but the Jays do seem to have that problem on obviously more than just one spot in the diamond too. And it's something that they need to clean up. But at the same time, there's not a whole lot you can do right now because he's your starting left fielder. That's not going to change this year. This is just going to be something that they're going to have to live with.
Always appreciate the time, Gregor. We'll do it again down the road. Thank you for this.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Here's Gregor Chisholm of the Toronto Star. Jays are off to Boston. They're at Fenway tonight throughout the weekend, dropping 2 of 3 against the Sox, and they're 31-29 through 60 games. So we're about 35% through the season, too. Like, we've got some serious data on who they are, what they are, and they're streaky, and they're hovering around 500, and they're having a difficult time against the best teams. You know, Houston's got them a couple of times. The Sox got them. Tampa swept them. You know, they got a bunch of games coming up against bad teams, Baltimore, Seattle, more against Miami upcoming.
Right. You mentioned the best teams. When you don't have heat and you're starting pitching, that's what's going to happen to the best teams. Like, you can't go in there and compete against them. It's just not possible.
Yeah, and then you compound that with a bullpen that is weak. Yeah.
Those garbage
right
teams,
now.
They'll mash. Like, they'll mash them. Yeah.
You can mash against them, exactly. You can outrun produce, you know, and make sure that you're okay. Rays coming up. Ray Ferraro in about 15 minutes. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on TSN 4. You guys see Russell Wilson is doing the rounds, trying to convince everyone he never requested a trade out of Seattle, and he wants to retire a Seahawk, which is PR 101, and it's a smart play. It's a smart play. You have to do it.
Why not just to sit at home until you – if you want to get traded, sit at home until you're traded. Stop the crap. But I get these guys can demand where they want to go, Hayes, but do it or don't. Don't come back to everyone and say it was a bunch of lies. It's not.
It's not, but he knows he's not going to get traded. So if you're not going to be traded, show up, put on a happy face, and say I love it here. Because what's the point of moping around or saying I don't like it? Or then people are going to turn on you. Like, you know, you might as well play the PR game. The team's going to do it. And that's what Wilson's doing here. And I think it's a smart play.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's going to retire a Seahawk. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but he's playing there this year.
It's smart because all he's doing is disarming people, going, hey, that was nothing. You know what? Nothing to see here. I love it here. Want to play here. And if he wants out in a year or wants out, he'll figure it out.
Then he'll figure it out. Exactly. And that's all it is. It's a PR play. And Seattle will say we love Russ, and they should love Russ. They better love Russ. I mean, he's still a top five or seven quarterback in the league, and they need him.
Yeah.
And he's back, so it's all good. Final hour coming up. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on the TSN app.
You're listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 1, powered by Rust-Oleum, home of trusted quality and powerful solutions since 1921. From fabric paint to roof repair, epoxy floor coatings, rust-fighting paint, and more, Rust-Oleum has a solution for every challenge.